verses, he describes the response of the land and God's people at the coming of God. Hope and joy. The desert and the parched land will be glad. The wilderness will rejoice and blossom. Like the crocus, it will burst into bloom. It will rejoice greatly and shout for joy. The glory of Lebanon will be given to it, the splendor of Carmel and Sharon. They will see the glory of the Lord, the splendor of our God. Strengthen the feeble hands, steady the knees that give way. Say to those with fearful hearts, be strong, do not fear. Your God will come. He will come with vengeance, with divine retribution. He will come to save you. Then will the eyes of the blind be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then will the lame leap like a deer, and the mute tongue shout for joy. Water will gush forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The burning sand will become a pool, the thirsty ground bubbling springs. In the haunts where jackals once lay, grass and reeds and papyrus will grow. And a highway will be there. It will be called the Way of Holiness. It will be for those who walk on that way. The unclean will not journey on it. Wicked fools will not go about on it. No lion will be there, nor any ravenous beast. They will not be found there. But only the redeemed will walk there, and those the Lord has rescued will return. They will enter Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church, Whakarongo ki te kupu, te wairoa ki te hahi. Thanks be to God. Kia mau tonu tana kupu te tātou. Our gospel reading is from Matthew chapter 11, verses 2 to 11. Praise and glory to God. Te whakamoe mititi, roria ata ata. Jesus had been teaching, healing, and preaching. Despite that, his cousin John, who had announced his coming, was now having second thoughts. Was he really the Christ after all? When John, who was in prison, heard about the deeds of the Messiah, he sent his disciples to ask him, "Are you the one who is to come, or should we expect someone else?" Jesus replied, "Go back and report to John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is proclaimed to the poor. Blessed is anyone who does not stumble on account of me." As John's disciples were leaving, Jesus began to speak to the crowd about John. "What did you go out into the wilderness to see? A reed swayed by the wind? If not, what did you go out to see? A man dressed in fine clothes? No, those who wear fine clothes are in kings' palaces. Then what did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you, and more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it is written, 'I will send my messenger ahead of you and will prepare your way before you.' Truly, I tell you, among those born of women, there has not risen anyone greater than John the Baptist. Yet whoever is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he." This is the gospel of Christ. Tarongapai tene atakaraiti. Praise to Christ the Word. Whakamoe matitia ia te kupu mana.
Kia ora koutou. I'll turn myself on.
Literally, I'm on. Yep. We did talk about ears being unstopped, so that will have well and truly unstopped some ears. Kia ora koutou, welcome everybody. It's good to be here this morning. My name's Andrew, for those who don't know me. Quite profound passages, those. And so a few reflections this morning as we head into Advent, as we're in the midst of Advent, the waiting for the coming, or the remembering again, the coming of Jesus Christ. So question here to ask you first of all, which is, how do those who aren't part of the church, what do they think of Christians? For those who don't attend, who know nothing of Christianity, what are the defining characteristics that they think of when they think of Christians and Christianity? That's a question for yourself. You don't need to necessarily give me an answer. But what do they think of? When you walk around and you meet people, what do they think of Christians and Christianity? I've been teaching a pre-Christmas summer school course for the University of Otago. I work there as a lecturer in theology. And therefore, I have a large number of students who are doing this course, not because they're theology students, just because it's the end of the year and they need some extra credits. And therefore, a large number of them are not Christians, have never done theology at all. The course I've been teaching is on war and violence and Christian reflections on war and violence during the centuries. And in other years when I've taught this course, therefore, the first thing that often gets raised by these students is, yes, but the Christians were involved in the Crusades and the Inquisitions, and they proceed to list off all these events of church history, which one cannot ignore. But this year, what has been striking for me is the kind of the focus on contemporary, prominent, attention-grabbing forms of Christianity, and in particular, essentially white nationalist evangelical movements in the States. So these students are like, hey, we're looking at Christianity, and what we see coming out of the United States, if this is Christianity, this is awful. We don't want to have a bar of sort of these people who are pronouncing sort of the Great Replacement Theory, who are anti-immigration, who are attacking refugees, or Christians who have conflated sort of God's covenant with Israel, with the modern nation-day state Israel, and therefore think that anything that happens is okay and condonable. This is awful. Or closer to home, hey, we look at sort of Christian leaders who are anti-immigration, anti-LGBTQ, who sort of launch these sort of really strident campaigns and marches, which are prominent in aggression, anger, displays of power and intimidation, have a scapegoating mentality, and often, if we're honest, basically look like the far right. And they say, wow, if that's what Christianity is, that's deeply disturbing. Now, of course, this is not new. These realities that we face now in the world have often taken place. In the 1930s, in Nazi Germany, there was the German Christian movement who decided that Jesus needed to be remade for more political purposes. So what needed to be replaced was a sort of weak Jewish rabbi with instead a strong Aryan leader. Jesus was remade in the image of Nazi Germany for German Christians, not the confessing church. But neither does the far right have the monopoly on this sort of utilization of Jesus. So, you know, we have one stream of Christianity which is campaigning for family values, the shutting of borders, the deporting of the immigrants, in which essentially Christianity becomes some sort of cultural nationalist renaissance project. But then there's another stream of Christianity which is sort of this radical progressive Christianity in which Jesus is no longer a cultural ideologue but is now a social justice warrior who is there to be our mascot for engaging with social justice or political advocacy. And I want to suggest that sort of this is kind of a little bit problematic because both of these forms of Christianity, it strikes me, actually have something similar in common and something which is unique about the time we live in, which is we live in an attention economy. We're obsessed with gaining attention, of having power and influence. certainly, don't get me wrong here, Christian faith should permeate our lives and should transform the way in which we live, the political decisions we make, the economic consumption choices, what we buy, our interaction with fellow human beings and with creation. But what I'm intrigued by here with both of these sort of forms of what I call performative public Christianity is the way in which they are embedded within sort of this performative reality of the 21st century, where our thoughts, our ideas, our desires are all, maybe for a younger generation, shared with the world at large constantly on social media, where we jostle for attention, where we seek to become influencers, for our voice and our perspectives to be heard, to tell everybody what I'm thinking, what I'm engaging with, what petitions I'm signing, what issues I feel strongly about. In contrast to these sort of performative forms of Christianity, which are highly politicised and have a great deal of emphasis on gaining attention, is the story from the Gospel this morning. John, prophet, is now living in prison. Or as people often say to me, because I'm not on social media, they say, oh, you must live under a rock. And this must be John's experience. He was the centre of attention, the hubbub and the constant gaze and discussion of him being sort of this key leader who's been living in the desert with people coming out to him to confess their sins, to be part of this renewal movement. And now he's in prison, living under a rock, away from this constant gaze of attention. And he hears rumours of his cousin's new ministry. And so he sends some disciples off to go and have a clandestine meeting with Jesus. There's a sense here in which it's kind of like a spy movie, because if you think about it, John is a prophet, he's in prison, so then he would have had to orchestrate his disciples to come and visit them, and he's like, hey, this is what's going on, these are the rumours I'm hearing, can you go and check out, what is Jesus about? He's my cousin, what is this ministry that he's leading? And so they turn up to Jesus and they say, in a very kind of clandestine way, coded almost, are you the one who is to come, or are we to wait for another? Translation, are you the Messiah? Are you the Messiah that we are waiting for? Remembering here what the Messiah meant for Israel in the first century. Israel, who throughout its history has lived under imperial regimes and have this long-awaited hope of a leader who will make Israel great again. That's what they hope for, a leader who will come and be their Messiah. This is what the disciples come, John's disciples, they come and they say, are you the Messiah? But not quite as pointedly as that. And John answers the disciples' questions here in an interesting way. He doesn't deliver a long political treatise for his disciples to say, well, this is my political treatise and you need to go communicate this to John. He doesn't outline his strategic plans and see whether they might be interested in going back to John and see if they could form an alliance between these two ministries. He doesn't offer a PR campaign or a spin. He doesn't try to publicly remind John of his manifesto, which he's already delivered earlier in the Sermon on the Mount. Nor does he attempt to woo John's followers to leave their imprisoned leader and to throw in their lot with the new kid on the block. And most strikingly, what he doesn't do is he doesn't draw attention to himself. He doesn't state his credentials for being the Messiah. He doesn't speak about how successful his ministry is. He doesn't speak about how many new followers he has attracted or gained since he kicked off this ministry. Nor does he announce himself as some new apostolic prophetic leader or the Messiah. What does he say to his disciples? To John's disciples? He says, look around you. Be attentive to what you see is taking place. And then go and report what you've seen to John. What is taking place? Jesus says, tell John what you saw and heard, what you have witnessed. The blind are receiving sight. The lame are walking, the lepers are being cleansed and welcomed back into community, the deaf are having their ears unstopped, the dead are being raised to life, and the poor are experiencing good news. Or, to capture that in one word. This is joy. This is joyous. This is life. This is what is being seen. This is what's taking place. Go and report to John that you see an outbreaking of joy. Jesus here doesn't say that the evidence that's required for John's to understand him as a Jewish Messiah is that he has reclaimed control of the Jewish elite and is building a political religious base to retake control of the institutions. Nor does Jesus tell him to go tell John that he has created a group of people who are going to overthrow Roman rule. These forms of messiahship are already apparent within the first century. In fact, they're going on all the time. And this is the reason that John sends his disciples to see Jesus, because there were lots of messianic pretenders or contenders who were involved in these sorts of actions, who are trying to build political bases, who are trying to create revolutionary movements that would bring about the greatness of Israel again. But Jesus' messiahship is very different. He's not trying to find a scapegoat for those who are stealing jobs and identities, nor is he trying to kill the oppressors. Instead, he's announcing to people to love their enemies, to pray for those who persecute you. He is proclaiming the goodness of God, whose rain falls on the just and the unjust. This is the kingdom that Jesus says they should go and report to John in prison. An outbreaking of joy. The evidence that the kingdom is present. What does this mean for us today in light of those two realities, the sort of the world of polarization and obsession with attention, a highly politicized Jesus, and yet the story here of Jesus who turns attention away from himself to actually what's taking place through his ministry? What might this mean for us? What might the Spirit be saying to us individually, but also in our shared lives here in this parish? I want to suggest two things here, at least, that it strikes me that the Spirit is saying, possibly. The first is the nature of Christ, the church, and the kingdom, a reminder what this is about. Jesus' messiahship in the first century is not of an ideological leader who draws attention to himself, amasses power, and uses coercion, intimidation, or power politics to force change within a society. Jesus Christ comes not in power, but as an infant. He does not exercise coercion as a political leader, but rather stands before Pilate in silence and ultimately goes to a humiliating, torturous death on a Roman cross. Jesus Christ is the kenosis of God, the humbling of God, who takes on, in the words of Philippians, the form of a servant and makes himself nothing to death on a cross. This is the Jesus of the first century, and this, therefore, is still the reality of the resurrected Jesus Christ today, present at work in the church today. In a minute, we will come and encounter this Jesus Christ at the table, a Christ whose power is demonstrated in his weakness. For my students over summer school course, as we read through these gospel accounts, as we read through the New Testament together, for many of these students who had never read these texts before, they were overwhelmed. They said, wow, this is not the conquering warrior that we expected to see. This is the victim who offers their life in self-sacrificing love. This is the God whose power is demonstrated in absolute weakness, who refuses to strike back and therefore breaks the cycle of tit-for-tat human violence. A crucified God who overcomes human violence and hatred through self-giving sacrificial love. They were stunned. And more, they stood there and they said, well, how does this cohere with the sort of forms of Christianity that we're seeing rising within the world? And those were good questions to ask, and I didn't have answers. This is who Jesus is, and therefore it's a real reminder for us about what the nature of the church is. The church is the body of Christ. We are not a conservative political organisation who's here to decry the decline of Christian society, to wage war on liberal woke progressives, or to reinstate Christian values within our education system, uphold family values, get tough on crime, etc. But nor are we a movement who wants to condemn lazy, idolatrous, middle-class conservatives who live lives of privilege and are calling them to somehow give up their privilege and to declare their sin of privilege and to bring about justice in a marginalised world. We are neither of those things. We are a community of broken people who are aware of our failings, our own desire for attention, our tendency to scapegoat and blame others, our tendency to self-righteousness and pride. We're also a community of the forgiven, because despite all those realities, we are accepted and loved by Jesus Christ. And fundamentally, we're a community that is being saved. The operative word there, being saved. That is, we are experiencing in our own lives the wonder and the joy of being transformed, of seeing anew, of having our ears unstopped, of finding courage to be faithful, to get up, to lose our lameness and to walk, to be transformed in our bodies, hearts, souls and minds. What might this mean for us? Two reflections. If this is our understanding, therefore, of Jesus and of the church and of the kingdom, I want to suggest two things, implications, an implication and an invitation. The first is how we might, therefore, understand Christian leadership. I began by reflecting on certain forms of Christian leadership that we see around us within our society, which are gaining lots of attention. And we're in the midst at the moment of discerning who will be our new vicar here, and what does that mean for someone to come and journey with us and lead us? I want to suggest that authentic Christian leadership is shaped in the image of Jesus Christ. It's humble. It doesn't draw attention to oneself, but it points beyond themselves to what's going on. It's interesting here in this passage that Jesus says to John, as he sends back John's disciples, he says, "Blessed is anyone who takes no offence at me." And I was reflecting on that this week as I was teaching my students, and I was thinking, wow, so much of what I see taking place at the moment is actually Christian leaders who seek to cause offence, who seem to take delight in causing offence. And yet Jesus says, "Blessed is anyone who takes no offence at me." Why? Because what he's bringing shouldn't be offensive. It actually should bring great joy, because something joyful is taking place as lives are transformed. So that's an implication. I think that's important for us to recognise the nature of Christian leadership, those who are exercising roles of leadership, but also as we discern together the nature of the leaders amongst us. But also, probably most importantly here in this season of Advent, is an invitation for each of us and for us communally to train our eyes to see the evidence of Jesus Christ at work in our lives, in our midst, but also beyond us. What should we be looking for? A loud goods train. In the first century, Jesus says what they should be looking for is the blind receiving sight, the lame walking, lepers being cleansed, the deaf hearing, the dead coming to light. And there's a sense in which we could say, oh, so maybe what we should be looking for or what we should be engaged in is some form of charismatic revival Christianity. What we should be running is healing meetings so that all those things can take place. Possibly. It is wonderful when those things happen. But I have a couple of sort of a little bit misgivings about that form of focus. One is because that form of Christianity does two things. It either tends to look back to an idealized past, which is, if only the Spirit moved in the way it did back in the whatever era, or it looks forward to sort of this idealized future. And while we're doing that, we're losing sight of what is Jesus Christ doing now in our midst. So our attention becomes either backwards or forwards rather than here. How is Christ at work in our lives? The second reason I have misgivings with this is because these forms of revival Christianity, as wonderful as they are, often also then get caught up with celebrity leaders who draw a lot of attention to themselves. What do those verses mean to us? What does it mean for us to look in the world and to see people seeing, hearing, walking, being transformed? Maybe like John's disciples, the key instruction we need to hear as we come into the season of Advent is to receive fresh sight. What does it mean for us to see the world again anew? To see the fact that while the world is broken and bruised, it is also saturated with grace. As we've sung this morning, there is light that is there in the darkness that is breaking out. What does it mean for us as we go into Advent to learn to hear again clearly, to shut out all the noise and clutter and chaos, and to tune in to the still small voice of the Spirit that is speaking to us, that is prompting us, that is reminding us that we are loved, that is encouraging and challenging us? What does it mean to then respond to find strength in our legs, to therefore walk in obedience? What does it mean, like healed lepers, for us to have the courage to step across the boundaries and norms that we construct, often to isolate ourselves from others, or to protect ourselves from harm? What does it mean to cross those boundaries, to become reconnected with communities we become isolated from? That is, what does it mean for us to take seriously that Christ has come into the world and is bringing a world of joy? As we come to the table in a minute, let's come to the table with anticipation, with hearts of expectancy to encounter again the good news of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ who lives amongst us and is transforming us into a people of joy that we might be his messengers to the world. Amen.
Andrew, I hope those students who are chasing credits realised what a privilege it is to be taught by you. Thank you. Please stand for our next song.